Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 10th of April, and coming up on the program, the Electoral Court clears Jacob Zuma to run for Parliament. Should we be surprised? We'll look at the Judicial Services Commission process in selecting new judges, particularly the Constitutional Court and the Land Court. Accounting's official body responds to stress claims by black practitioners. And at what point can state-sponsored violence lead to a civil society fight back? Now, you'll be well aware the Electoral Court has set aside a decision by the Electoral Commission of South Africa, the IEC, to bar Jacob Zuma from running for Parliament. Now, in effect, this means the former president can contest a seat in the National Assembly in the upcoming election on the 29th of May. Political commentator and writer Sanusha Naidu leads our program today. Sanusha, we can look at the ins and outs in just a moment, but one thing is for sure. Campaigning up until May the 29th is going to be a whole lot more interesting.
Good day, Jeremy, and good day to your listeners. Absolutely. I think it's going to be very intense. It's going to be very animated. You're going to see a lot of aggressiveness is the word that I'm looking for in terms of how they're going to go forward. I think this decision yesterday by the Electoral Court vindicates the MK in so many ways, and it strengthens them in terms of their legitimacy, their credibility, the challenges that they pose to the ANC, both in terms of trademark and whether they were rightfully a legitimate party to contest this election based on the previous application made by the ANC to say that the rules were not applied in an effective way in terms of their qualification to register as a political party. So all of this kind of gives them that oomph going forward.
The Electoral Court's decision, though, to challenge or at least reinterpret Section 47 of the Constitution that bars individuals sentenced to prison for longer than 12 months without an option of a fine from becoming MPs is something for the books. It did come as a surprise, given that the widely held view was one of not being eligible.
Yeah, I mean, the conventional view was that the way the IEC had interpreted that rule in terms of the disqualification of the former president was kind of said, well, this is par for the course. This is how the rule should be interpreted. It will be very important for us to get the judgment, which hasn't been released yet by the Electoral Court, in terms of how they arrived at this decision, in terms of their interpretation of that Section 47. And I think it's important as well because it raises a whole lot of unintended consequences around the legal framework and the legal interpretation of these kinds of rules going forward. And it will also kind of create a precedent because, you know, in law, precedent is critical when arguing cases down the line. So it will be very important for constitutional law experts and the legal fraternity, as well as for us as ordinary people not having that nuanced understanding of the law, to be able to have that kind of assessment of how it's broken down in this context. And it will be, I think that's what the IEC is also waiting for, what their legal team are waiting for in terms of where they go as next steps.
It does, though, say something about the state of democracy in South Africa, particularly, Sanusha, in the context of checks and balances between different branches of government.
Yes, and for a long time, the judiciary didn't want to veer into that kind of, extending or overreaching itself into the mainframe of, say, the legislature, or in terms of how it actually wants to tell the legislature to do its job. And I think now we end up in a situation where the separation of powers is really very important, but it's also critical in a sense to say, well, if the laws are being made in this way by the legislature, and the interpretation of these laws are to be now held by the judiciary, then of course the question is, how do these two branches of the state actually kind of interpret the same kind of policy, the same kind of legal statute and the framework? And it kind of raises those questions about, you know, how the Constitution is also being interpreted within this framework that we're looking at, because very often we are told that the Constitution is, you know, one of the best constitutions we have in the world. It's really kind of, you know, holds up the Bill of Rights, etc. But it has, now we're beginning to see, and this is my interpretation, and I'm not a constitutional law expert, or nor am I a legal expert, but you're beginning to see some of the loopholes, some of the issues that are coming down the line in terms of the strict interpretation and implementation of what is a Section 47 versus Section 88, and versus how this is interpreted in terms of the Electoral Act, and more importantly, who are candidates that can actually be on candidate lists and so forth. Last point, Jeremy, to make in this context as well is, I think in terms of what does the Constitution say, because there's another argument that's also coming in here, and that is, what does the Constitution say about former President Jacob Zuma standing for, or being nominated rather, for a third term as President of the Republic?
What we don't need right now, Sanusha, and in the absence of a full judgment, is whether there are grounds for appeal, and also clarity about whether the Constitutional Court itself could hear an appeal by the IEC against the decision. That's going to suck a lot of oxygen out of the climate in the run-up to May 29.
Yeah, and it's going to be completely, you know, it's going to be a very volatile, it's already a volatile climate, as you say, suck out a lot of the oxygen, but we don't have the time in terms of, when does the Constitutional Court sit, how does it go forward, what is the decision? And of course, the other element to this as well is how institutions like the IEC have been caught in the narrative of being discredited, being delegitimized, and its integrity being challenged. And so if you're going to start continuing to ventilate this around the litigation of this and continue to appeal it, it doesn't give us time, because the IEC has to get to doing its work. It needs to start printing those enormous ballot papers that is going to take a lot of energy, and also people have to be educated about how those ballot papers are going to affect them in terms of having three as opposed to two. It's a whole lot of technical stuff that needs to go in. And if you're going to have this continuously being litigated, you're not finalizing the candidate list as well.
And just as far as the MK party and Jacob Zuma are concerned, we know that he has a significant role and is ostensibly the face of the party. They will now go full bore, won't they? And this will be, as you said in the beginning of our conversation, this will be of some concern to the African National Congress, particularly in his stronghold of KwaZulu-Natal.
Indeed. And I think, you know, they've already started to become that bold. They've been emboldened by this whole thing. I mean, they if you look at the fact that they were so confident that the judgment will be in their favor in terms of his disqualification under the rule, and they said they have a very strong case and they're going to win this case. So they really got that momentum, and they're going to continue to build on that momentum. I mean, whether they produce a kind of narrative that says that, you know, we are here and we are a political party that is constantly being vindicated by the fact that there's a political witch hunt against us, and whether it's institutions, whether it's other political actors, whether it's civil society, the media. I mean, you could just see that whole thing kind of, you know, saber rattling happening outside the court on Monday when former President Zuma addressed the supporters and spoke about the IEC and what the role of the IEC should be, and then talking about his unfinished business at the Union Building. So I think it's already there, and it's going to be quite an important dynamic, and a very, very serious dynamic for the ANC, but also other political parties who now have to deal with the fact that this this MK party is becoming stronger in terms of where it's going to be. Whether or not, you know, it's going to become the party that they say going to win the majority of the votes, we already know that the MK party has started to make pronouncements on an election that has not even been held yet.
I am going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for that very crisp analysis. Political commentator and writer Sanusha Naidu.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The search for new judges is on, and says our next guest, the Judicial Service Commission sitting this week is a damp squib. With only 13 candidates to be interviewed for 4 vacancies at various superior courts, including the Constitutional Court, the JSC sitting will be one of the least productive since the COVID-19 pandemic. That view is from Mbekizeli Benjamin, who is Research and Advocacy Officer at the organization, the NGO Judges Matter. It's a civil society organization that monitors judicial appointments. He's with me now. And first of all, your assessment of the process so far?
So far, the process over the last 3 days has been a much improved process from what we've seen in the past. Usually, the JSC is sidetracked by issues that are not really relevant to assessing the fitness of the candidates to be judges. And this time around, it sort of has turned a corner because we're seeing a lot more focus on the candidates' experience, their work in the law, whether they are academics, so their publications, whether they are practitioners, so the kind of cases that they've worked on, and the complexity of the legal matters that they've been handling. So that for us is important because it indicates that the JSC is a lot more focused on trying to get the best out of the candidates and sort of assessing their fitness to be judges, particularly of the Constitutional Court and other courts like the Land Court. So for us, it's quite a positive round that we've seen so far.
Let's talk about the Constitutional Court in just a moment, but why do you think the JSE has upped its game? What's changed, do you think?
I think what we're seeing now is the JSC sort of settling on key principles and key reforms that they've initiated since last year. One of them is just having written criteria to guide the process. That for us was really important because we saw it as a key weakness. And we've been quite critical of it over many, many years. And so last year, the JSC formally adopted written criteria, which sets out quite clearly what kind of qualities they need from the candidates. The first use of those criteria was last year in October. So this time around, it's the second time. And it seems as if things are settling around those key qualities that they need. The second part is a lot more focus on rules and procedure of how the interview should be conducted. So in the past, there was a bit of a free-for-all. Commissioners could ask any question under the sun. And what we see now is a lot more focus and emphasis on questions that are more relevant to the criteria that they've adopted. And we've seen, for example, the Chief Justice step in and overrule some of the questions and emphasize that if an objection, for example, hasn't been raised with the candidate and the candidate has been given an opportunity to respond to it prior to the interview, then it cannot be raised during the course of the interview. That has sort of boosted the ways in which the commissioners can behave themselves. It sort of restrained them and sort of drawn their focus and attention on the real qualities that are needed. So that for us is something that we are quite pleased to see. But of course, we do have a little bit of criticism still.
Well, let's talk about the criticism, which I imagine might be around the Constitutional Court position. 4 candidates remaining after 1 withdrawal. Inevitably, this is going to pose a challenge for the JSC in meeting the constitutional requirement to present at least 4 candidates to the president. That is of concern, surely.
Yes, absolutely. We are quite disappointed, in fact, that the JSC sort of proceeded with just the bare minimum of candidates, because the Constitution requires that for 1 position on the Constitutional Court, they need to send to the President a minimum of 4 names. And this time around, they only had those 4 names. So if for any reason they found one of the candidates not appointable, as they did in this round, then they cannot proceed with sending the names through to the president. That could have been avoided if the JC did a lot more proactive work in trying to get some of the broader set of candidates to make themselves available for appointment. A lot of the candidates or potential candidates have said to us they are not willing to come forward and present themselves to the JC if the interviews are going to be a process of humiliation and questions that are irrelevant to their suitability for appointment. And so that has needed the JSC to reflect and introspect in their own process, but also to take a more proactive measure to try and attract the right candidates. So that for us is work that still needs to be done by the JSC.
What is important is the inclusion of candidates from more diverse professional backgrounds. That is going to broaden things, surely, from a judicial perspective. And I imagine that is a good thing.
Yes, it is actually a good thing. We do welcome it, especially at the constitutional court level. You do need, obviously, people who have judicial experience. And in fact, the constitution itself requires that a minimum of 4 members of the constitutional court must have been judges prior to their appointment to the constitutional court. But that leaves the majority of members of the Constitutional Court to have come from a more diverse set of experiences. And one of those has been academic. So we know that law professors haven't been appointed to the Constitutional Court in more than 25 years. And recently, the Chief Justice has invited some law professors to make themselves available. And the value of that is that a lot of the law professors have a lot of focus and attention on building the theories, the big constitutional theories that are needed to answer the big constitutional questions that come before the Constitutional Court. We also have a weakness, for example, in the Constitutional Court on issues like a private law, on commercial law, on tax, for example. We don't currently have a tax expert on the Constitutional Court. So drawing them from the academia would help because they would be steeped in the questions and the complexities of an area like tax law. So for us, it is a welcome development, and we wish that more professors would make themselves available for appointment to the Constitutional Court.
And thank you very much indeed for a very thorough assessment. And Mbeki Zili Benjamin from Judges Matter.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, we reported previously that the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants administers something called the Assessment of Professional Competence. This exam is the last hurdle for aspiring accountants, CAs, to qualify. The latest results, released late February, if I'm not mistaken, had an overall pass rate of just over 50%. But here's the issue. The pass rate for white candidates, 76%. For black candidates, 39%. Sedzani Musundwa is a registered chartered accountant. Accountant and accounting lecturer who has researched the experiences of black chartered accountants. And she painted in a conversation yesterday a picture of marginalization and also mental health problems. This is what she had to tell us.
A lot of the trainees that I interviewed as part of my PhD speak about unfair work allocation. So they deem themselves to not be getting the same exposure as what their counterparts are getting. It's also the rating system. So ratings for the general person is your performance reviews. So you're doing your work, you're working your guts out, and your performance review comes out, and there's a bit of a shock to the system.
All right, I'm in conversation now with Patricia Stock from the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. She is the Chief Executive Officer. Patricia, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. First of all, why the pass rate disparity, 52% versus 39%? Do you have a view?
Good afternoon, Brother Jeremy, to you and your listeners. Definitely, we do have a view. Firstly, I would like to pick up on the key principle with respect to our program. As SAICA, we follow a structured and equitable approach to providing each trainee with the exposure that they require. Right? So when you look at the pass rate, we have to look at the entire ecosystem when we consider what could be the contributing factors. Firstly, on the pass rate, it's important that we reflect on where we are as a profession when we talk about transformation of the profession itself. What is encouraging, Jeremy, is that as a profession, we've actually unpacked and analyzed the numbers, and we see that there has been an encouraging growth with respect to representation of Black members and candidates themselves that sit for our examinations. So where we are currently, overall, we're sitting with 35% of our Black members, right? But then when we look at it at the youth level, right, at members that are below 35, we're sitting with 53%. And that consideration is very key, especially when you look at the study that was done, because it looked at 2016. So I just wanted to first put that context for you. So the contributing factors, it's important that we look at the entire ecosystem, especially when you look when we want to solve for the root causes of why we're seeing the numbers that we see on the pass rate. Firstly, when we talk about the broader education system, there are quite a number of factors, right, that are contributing when we look at the broader societal issues. And those factors have proven that early development in mathematics, as an example, does contribute to the ability of our candidates to be able to apply analytical and critical skills. And in addition to that, Jeremy, language plays a very important role, right, with regards to the candidate's ability to, you know, apply comprehension when they now look at the examination questions themselves. And the second element, it's the contribution from the historically disadvantaged institutions. When we analyzed the results, they actually revealed that certain of our HDIs, which is the actual institutions themselves, they struggle with ITC, right, when we look at the output. This obviously may be due to several factors, such as the broader education system itself in terms of what comes from the entire ecosystem. We look at the education at the basic education level. And this contributes to the comprehension by candidates as well.
Okay, so I think you've broadly outlined the background for me. The interview that I had yesterday, and you've listened to an excerpt of it, also spoke about the entire journey, experiences of injustice every step of the way, mental health issues, feelings of incompetence, being sidelined by companies themselves. This is not a satisfactory state of affairs, surely.
Jeremy, we've noted that's the study with great concern, because when we look at the word use of injustice, in our view, the study does not fully represent the reality of what's happening on the ground. And why we say that, because SAICA, we follow very strict processes to monitor what's happening in the offices. And as part of that monitoring process, we actually engage directly with our candidates who are the trainees themselves, right, that are going through the program.
So are you suggesting that the assertion that some Black accountants are simply sidelined, they're not given tasks which they believe that they're up to doing, is not true at all? Is that not happening?
No. And the key word there is some. So we cannot discount that there could be, there are instances where some candidates did not go through a pleasant experience in their training.
But it is a lived reality of some people, and that is casting an aspersion on the profession, surely.
No, absolutely it is. But actually the study and the stats and the outcome of our reviews are not actually showing that is prevalent to the entire profession. And we do not take it for granted, Jeremy. For us, it's a serious matter, because when we look at diversity, equity and inclusion, it's very critical to ensure that that is a lived experience and it's embraced in the profession as a whole.
So how do you believe the situation can be rectified then, even if it's not an issue which applies to all accountants? And I will accept that. But as we've agreed, if it happens to some people, it is still a problem. What can one SAICA do, and perhaps more importantly, the big accounting firms?
What we do, we actually investigate any allegations in relation to this with respect to specific training officers. So when we do our accreditation monitoring reviews, which we use independent reviewers, and which a large portion of it is Black reviewers, right? So when we identify this kind of instances, we follow up with the relevant firms as part of our follow-up investigations, and we ensure that there are corrective actions that are implemented by the various firms.
So have you found transgressions? And if you have, has there been sanction?
Yeah. So we with the last review cycle of 280 training officers that we reviewed, we had one training office that we identified to be of a high risk in this instance. And what we do is we actually monitor them closely. We do follow-up reviews in a short period of time to make sure that whatever corrective actions that they've committed to, that they implement them. Hence we say some, because one out of 280, you'll agree with me that it's not representative of the entire profession, but it doesn't take away the fact that it is a challenge. It is a concern.
Patricia Stock is the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. Right of reply, and thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally today, our guest is suggesting that it takes an incredibly short time for a palpable economic challenge to shapeshift into a political crisis of what he terms state legitimacy. Dr. Buntu Sewisa is a senior researcher at the Southern Center for Inequality Studies at Wits University here in Johannesburg, and writes that all it takes is a series of human rights violations meted out by the state. He joins us now. And Dr. Sewisa, first of all then, how close is South Africa to experiencing this, or are we already experiencing it?
I think that what the scenario analysis really that I project is that we are not going to have a kind of Arab Spring revolt. So it's not going to be a one-time cataclysmic kind of event, but we are going to have an incremental form of protest, and this will be will basically come in a series of human rights violations, and then after that we will then see this blow up of protests, of a series of protests, which will then overshadow the narrative of economic challenges to a rather political crisis of the legitimacy of the state.
How will those human rights violations manifest, and who would be responsible in terms of your research?
Well, the securitization of state responses to inequalities, conflicts, as I stated in the article, it mainly will come from local government, municipal services delivery, and the securitization will mainly come from the police. And there are now worrying concerns, particularly with the so-called wardens who come from the Gauteng Premier's office, that this will further add on to the potential for conflict. So here we see community organizations or spontaneous forms of uprisings pitted against security responses, mainly coming in the form of represented by the police mainly. And I don't really see particularly the SANDF coming in, unless perhaps there will be more of kind of a national blow up of these concerns.
We've seen evidence of this happening for a long time though, and we haven't reached a tipping point yet, have we?
No, we haven't reached a tipping point. And what is worrying really is that the forms of securitized responses from the police emanate, and the concerns, they emanate from the lack of professionalization of police's response. And we've seen a lot of faux pas, which have been quite damaging to communities, of how police have been responding to these forms of protest. And so that is an added worry to this, in that the type of training and the lack of professionalization of security responses will further add on to the hostilities people will have out of these economic hardships, the hostilities people will have against the state, whether it's the local state or the national representation of the state.
Does this come with the tacit approval of the government itself, or is it simply unaware that it's happening?
I think the government may be aware, because this is not the first time that South African police security and even the South African National Defence Force have responded in such a hardened way to these forms of protest. I think, as I pointed in the article, the 2013 killing of Andrew Statane was really, I think, the very first publicly chronicled form of securitized response. So I don't think the government is aware, but I think the government is quite complacent about these forms of protest and what they will mean and how potentially it will overshadow the economic challenges that we face as a country, and the economic challenges that I think we can contain in how we respond to them so that they do not spill over into some other narrative. So I think the government is aware, but the government is complacent. And the government is complacent with how we should respond to these challenges. And the government is complacent with how the security should respond to these challenges.
Dr. Siwisa, thank you very much indeed for that analysis. I appreciate it. And just before I leave you, on our online poll yesterday, we spoke about the search for a new permanent CEO for South African Airways. I asked you if some progress was being made, if it was all a waste of time, or if you used another carrier. 62% saying the entire process is a waste of time, and that obviously shows little confidence that the carrier, which certainly has diminished in size over the years. Today, as you heard us reporting at the top of the program, the Electoral Court clearing Jacob Zuma now to run for Parliament. Not surprised, concerning, or the ANC must be worried. If you have a view on that, I'll invite you to go to MoneyWeb on X or also on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.